Good afternoon. So last time we went over some logistics. We talked about these layers of abstraction we'd be going down. Started by a little tour review of C into assembly, which we'll get through today. Talk later on about machine code using something which is a little less of a toy than IBCM, and then talk about implementing actual hardware. And we'll go back up talking about things we can do in hardware to make our programs faster and more efficient, so on. After that sort of overview, we went over some miscellaneous topics. We talked about powers of two, which I said will probably be useful later on. Talked about this notion that we have this CPU, which is communicating with memory via some what we call a bus, and we could use the same abstraction to communicate with I/O devices. And the idea is the CPU asks for things to read and write things on that bus, and this is how it gets all its data. So this is how it gets its machine code. And if the machine code says to do something with memory, it does things based on that. And from the processor's perspective, we talked about memory just being this big array of bytes, and how it interprets that depends on what instruction it's writing. We talked about the issue of endianness. So if memory is an array of bytes, it turns out that a lot of the things we want to do involve more than one byte of memory. So we need to figure out how to interpret that. So we reviewed what little and big endian were. And we mentioned, speaking about memory more generally, talk about the layout of programs. So we have our possibly review. We have a stack, and in x86 it grows down towards a heap, which grows up. And below that we had sort of data and code and constants. And we said that this part is loaded from the executable. And we started talking about linking, which is how we go from having assembly files and assembly files which don't contain everything. Like we have a call to printf, but we don't have the implementation of printf in our assembly file. And somehow we end up with an executable which combines multiple C files, which produce multiple assembly files, into this one thing we can load, which has our data, our global variables, and our code and constants all ready to be loaded. So we started talking about that process known as linking, and we'll finish that up today. So any questions on things we covered last time before I move on? Yes?
So this little segment of memory, do we have a bunch of those at any given time, or is there like one of those and then you pull in each new program?
So the question is, we're running multiple programs. This is the layout of memory I shed for every program. So every program's gonna think it has this exact same layout. Even if multiple are running at the same time, there's gonna be some hardware support to make it so this can happen, even though we only have one memory and we might be running multiple programs on multiple processors at the same time. And we'll talk about that when we talk about what's known as virtual memory later in the semester. For now, we're going to kind of gloss over the issue and the differences between the memory we're accessing and what the quote-unquote real memory of the system is. When we talk about virtual memory, we'll go into a lot of detail about how that can actually work with multiple programs, all of which think they have their stack at the same location and all of which are running at the same time. Other questions? Okay, so a brief note about department accounts. If you had a department account last semester, it has the same password and you didn't get an email about it. If you don't know your department account passwords, unlike previous semesters, there is now a password recovery page which does not involve emailing people or going down to the bottom floor of Rice and talking to someone to get your password reset. You just need your NetBadge password to work, so you can use that. And if you don't have a department account, please let me know so I can do something about it. So I recommend having that as an option, even if you may not end up using it for doing homeworks in labs. So any questions on this piece of logistics? And a department account is for, to be clear, SSH or an X into including the portal machines, if you've used those before, or if you used NX before. That's what the department account is for. And there are instructions on how to do that linked off. If you look at the link in the schedule for this week's lab, there's a list of options for getting a Unix environment. The first one is SSH. We have a link for with specific instructions for using department accounts, the options for that. If you want to know about using SSH and so on, because maybe you didn't do it in 2150, even though they kind of talk about it, sort of. Okay, so let's go on to finishing up linking. So I mentioned last time we had our hello example. So here's a program that puts the string hello world, then returns zero. And we turn that into this assembly. This is AT&T syntax assembly. We'll talk about the differences between AT&T and Intel syntax more today because our textbook uses it, some tools we'll use it. It's the default on Linux and OS X, so it will come up in various places. So we're just gonna briefly tell you how to read that and also go over some things in assembly that you may not have learned or may have forgotten from 2150. So we have this assembly here, and we have this assembly file, and we want to convert this into an object file. So that's what the assembler is going to do. It's going to read this, and we don't want to, for the machine, we don't want to have the machine look for an S followed by a U followed by a B in hardware. Yes, this is a thing we could in fact do in hardware, but it's not worth it. We're going to have some hopefully better representation that we're going to use for the hardware in our machine code. And we also want to take this data here, this string hello world, and we just want to write hello world. We don't want it, the hardware to have to look for dot string in the label. So what we're going to do is we're going to take all these instructions and we're going to write that out to our object file. So we have different segments, and you've seen these marked in the assembly. Here I have this piece marked as text. Text means code. This is just a weird name for a code. So we have the code segment, and we have a separate data segment, and we're going to write these out as separate pieces because when we produce our executable, we're going to put them in different places in memory, so they're going to end up in different places in the executable file. So first, we'll write out our code segment, and the way this works is that we just take each of the instructions here and convert each of them one by one into machine code. And we write that out. I've shown it as hexadecimal. That doesn't mean it's hexadecimal in the actual object file, because that would waste a lot of space. So typically, it's just going to be those bytes in the file with some information around it to say how big it is and so on. And we'll do the same for the data segment. So here I've written in hexadecimal to be consistent, but this is just the ASCII for hello world followed by a null terminator. So we're missing a few things. So one thing, and we'll show you the correspondence. So some things we're fine with. So this subtract instruction in x86-64, this is the machine code for that. I don't expect you to understand how to figure that out, and we won't ever talk about it in this class, but that's the machine code for subtract 8 from RSP. So that was straightforward. Then we have this move instruction, but we need to move the address of this string into RDI, and when we're producing the object file, we don't actually know that yet. And we don't know that yet because, well, we don't know when we have our executable, we're going to have our code and our data. We don't know where in the data it's going to be and how big the code's going to be, so we can't figure out what that address would possibly be. And so what we'll do is we're just going to leave a placeholder. We'll just leave it blank. We'll leave it all zeros. We'll put, use the right amount of space, but we'll leave it blank for now. And the same thing is true, even more so, for putS. We don't know where the putS function is because we haven't even loaded the file which contains it yet. We don't know where that file is when we're producing this object file. It's not part of the executable, and we could change it later on. So we're going to have our call instruction, which starts with EA, and then we're going to have a placeholder of just zeros where we would put the information about where the putS function is. Now, we're going to need to fix this later on. It's not going to be acceptable to just have this end up in our final executable with that blank placeholder, then we try to call putS and it doesn't work. And we can't not record it in the object file. The object file needs to contain this information because when we're producing the executable, we don't want to go back to the assembly file and figure out, oh, what was that call instruction actually supposed to be? That's not going to make sense. We need everything we need to produce the executable needs to go in the object file. We're not going to look at the assembly file ever again. So that means we need to write down that we, I think this is, should be 11, that we made these placeholders. So we're saying that in this particular location, that I need to put the address that the data segment ends up at in those four blue bytes that I left as zeros. That I didn't actually know what was there, but the assembler is going to write down, hey, there's this blank placeholder I didn't know how to fill, and someone later on needs to deal with it. And the same thing for the call to putS, that there's this blank placeholder I don't know how to fill it in later on when you know what to do. So this is going to be written down as part of the object file. And each of these are known as relocations. The idea is that we're moving the code around. In order to do that, these relocations let us move the code, move where the call goes, and so on. So any questions about what I've shown so far? So we since we don't know where things are going to end up in memory, we don't know where the putS function is, we don't know exactly where in memory the data will be, we have to write these placeholders, and we record where they are, so later on we can fix them before we make the executable. So questions? Yes?
Yeah, how did they know where putS is?
How do we know where putS is? So in the object file, we're actually gonna put the name of putS. We're gonna write the string putS in the object file. So I have the and replaced with the address of putS. If you look in the raw object file, it's gonna actually contain the string PUTS. So later on, something's gonna read that string PUTS and get it. But you're asking, how do we know later on where putS is?
After you create the .o.
Yes. So for the call, the information the .o will contain is it will contain that this blank should be filled with wherever putS goes, and we'll represent that with the actual string putS. Does that make sense and answer your question? Yeah. So we'll actually put the string putS somewhere in the object file to represent that. Yes.
So it's while we wouldn't ever do it, it's technically reversible to go from .o to .s.
So the question is that I can go from my .o to .s. You can go from your .o to an equivalent .s. It's not consistently reversible. So for example, instead of writing this .string here, I could have written .byte h e. And I'd get a different .s, so there's lots of .s's which are equivalent, and we still lose some information. But you could recover a lot of the labels and so on. Yeah?
How do we mark where the text ends and the data starts and then where the data ends at the relocation?
So the question is, how do we mark where the text and data end? So I'm glossing over how the .o file formats work because it varies between systems. But there's going to be some convention that we have information about a list of segments and where the relocation is in some order or in some format. And every system has a different way of doing this. So what OS X does is different from what Linux does, is different from what Windows does for this. But the basic idea is that there's information at the beginning of the file which says these are the parts of the object file. Okay, and other questions? Okay, so there's one piece of information. I'm going to need to produce my executable, which I haven't written down yet, which is definitely going to be in the object file. Can someone tell me what that is? There's one thing that I am missing that I'm never going to be able to run my executable if I don't know about it. A halt.
Like a stop.
A stop. We have our return here. Something I'm missing from the .o file, I should say. We have a return here, so it's not going to be the case that code execution keeps going here. So that's not a problem if that's what you were worried about. Yeah.
We need puts.
So we need puts. So we're going to need another object file, yes. There's something that's in hello.s that I didn't record yet that I need to. So, but the other object file would be a different assembly file. Yeah?
Does the hashtag include
So do we need extra stuff for include standard IO? That's a possibility, and it's not clear. It turns out on most systems that the assembly file doesn't need to include any information for this code. There's other code that uses standard IO stuff where it might need to include some stuff from the .h file. Yeah.
Have we not specified where our main is?
So yes, we haven't specified where main is. When we produce the executable, we need to know where the executable starts execution. And we have to know where main is to do that. And we haven't written that down. I can't tell whether the assembly file had main here or had main here, for example, from the object file. And those should obviously do different things. And so we're going to have one additional piece of information in the object file, which is known as a symbol table. So that's going to be a list of names, of labels, and where those labels are in the object file. So we're going to write down main is at the beginning of the text segment. That's where it is. So later on when we're producing the executable, we know where the executable should start. Yeah?
So if we had a function that wasn't like puts, it was something that was actually in our .c file and then in our .x file, would we have a entry in the table for that function?
The question is if we had a function besides main that was in our .h file or in our .c, therefore in our .s file, would you have a table entry for it? Yes. So the symbol table has to have an entry for anything any other object file might use. So most notably, wherever puts is defined, there's going to be a .o file or something like it, which has a symbol table entry for puts. So after we have this object file, what's going to happen is we're going to take this object file and any other object files we need, like say the one that puts is defined in, and we're going to combine them all together, and we're going to figure out where all the symbols are. So we're going to figure out where main is, where put is. And after we figure that out, we're going to go through all these relocations. And we're going to say, OK, now that I know where the data segment of hello.o is, I know where I'm going to put that. And the reason I'm going to know that is because as I'm producing the executable, I'm going to decide how to lay out its memory. I'm going to decide, OK, I'm going to put hello.o at address, you know, say 4000, followed by hello.o, say the code, and let's say hello.o data, and I'm going to figure out what all these addresses are. As I'm laying that out, and from that, I'm going to know how to translate text byte 0 into an actual memory address, and I'm going to be able to fill in all my blanks. And in particular, you know, I'm just going to go through each of the relocations, fill in that blank, and that's how I'm going to get an executable. And my executable is going to end up being just this data writing to just copy into memory, basically. You know, and just something on top of that, just saying, this is where you copy it into memory. And that means that starting an executable is very simple. You just read, how much data do I have to load? You just copy it into memory at the right location and jump to where it says, and then you're done. Yes?
Just a quick question. So when it's replacing the placeholders with, like, once it actually knows what's going to go in them, what if it's, like, too large for the placeholder?
So the question is, what if my 4-byte placeholder, but I need a address which is not, I can't fit in 4 bytes? And the answer is that you'll get an error. So when the assembler needs to make a choice about what type of instruction it generates, like how big a placeholder it has, that's something you can usually configure in the assembler or write assembly slightly differently to indicate this is a call instruction which should have 8-byte placeholder. But basically, the way most systems handle this is they just say, we're going to make sure things are, you know, in the part of memory where we don't need to worry about that. So for example, for this move instruction, we're going to make sure all our data is in the first 4 gig of memory, no matter what. And if you don't do that, when you try to produce your executable, you'll get an error. Okay, other questions? So that's linking. So given that we have too many questions about that, let's try this. So here I have my main.c. So which of these files might contain the memory address of say hello, given this function? By memory address, I mean the address that it's going to have when the program is running. I'll give you a minute. You can talk to your neighbor if you like. Check your answer. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, anyone want to defend their answer? So we have a split between C and D. Yeah.
The executable needs to have it somewhere, right? Because it needs to know where to find this code.
Okay, so your argument is, so the executable needs it for the call?
The executable needs it, so it can't be A, B, or F, right?
Okay.
It's got to at least be in the executable. It's also going to be in the symbol table in the object file.
Okay. So you're saying the executable needs to have it because I think the call instruction is going to have a blank for it. Okay. And you're saying the symbol table should have it. So this is a common subtlety here. So what I put in the symbol table here is where in the object file the function is. And it's not the memory address. It is an address, which is very confusing, but it's an address in the file. It's not a memory address because it doesn't tell me where it is in memory because I don't know yet. I haven't decided. So there is an address in the object file, but not a memory address. So I think C is the best answer. Or there's an argument for F because maybe we generate assembly which just inlines the say hello function and doesn't call it. And we never use the address of it. The compiler might be clever and decide to, just say, oh, I can just put the text of say hello in main directly and not call it. In which case, it would not appear anywhere. So those are, I think, the reasonable answers. So let's try a second one. So how about the string hello world? And I say the literal ASCII string. So what I mean here is that if you open up each of these files in a text editor, main.s and main.o, which is, yes, a binary file, but if you open it up in a text editor, are you likely to see hello, comma, world, exclamation point? I'll give you a minute to think about this.
It's a literal S.
Yeah. If you open up in a text file, text editor, are you likely to see it? Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so let's start with what is probably, let's start by working backwards. When this program runs, it's going to print out this string. In order to print out this string, we're going to call puts with a pointer to the byte h followed by e, l, l, o, and so on. So that has to be in memory when the program runs, and it would be very complicated to generate code which writes that byte by byte in memory, so we probably have that loaded with the executable, which means it has to appear somewhere in the executable. Because when the executable runs, we're loading that into memory. It's going to appear as an ASCII string because that's what it's like in memory when we call puts, because it takes a C-style string, which remember is ASCII with a null terminator. So it's going to be in the executable. And if we open up the executable in the text editor, we'll see a bunch of unprintable junk and hello world exclamation point. That will be in there. Okay, so that's the executable. Let's also go over the easiest one here, which is in the assembly file, most likely, because we just showed you an example where it's probably in the assembly file. Technically, the compiler could do something like write it as .byte h, e, and it wouldn't be in there, but that seems unlikely, but it's probably in the assembly file. But yeah, not guaranteed. As for the object file, when we write the object file, we want to have the data, the machine code and the data just ready to be copied into the executable. We don't want there to be any interpretation besides the relocations. And there's no relocation, there's no placeholders in the middle of the string to fill in. So we're just going to have the raw string like we have here. And I wrote it out in hexadecimal here to keep things readable and consistent with the machine code. But typically in an object file format, maybe there's some exceptions, we'll write it out as just bytes, because if you write it out as hexadecimal with spacing like this, well, we're using three times as much space for your object files. And if you think about compiling something like Firefox, that's probably wasting like hundreds of megabytes of disk space. So you wouldn't want to do that. Okay, so I think the best answer is E. And I can see arguments for saying maybe it doesn't have to be in the assembly file, and maybe we could have a weird object file format, but I think most likely the answer would be E. Okay, so any questions? Yeah?
So when you say literal, you mean either the byte representation or, well, I guess they're both
regardless. Yeah. Yeah. The intuition I'm going for is that if you like take your text editor and open it up, you'll see it in there. Okay. So that's about linking. So I have two little nits about linking to talk about that we didn't cover. So one is that when I showed you relocations, I had this notion that we had a placeholder where we put an address. Machine code doesn't always work that way. So for example, on x86, the most common call instruction doesn't take an address, but it takes an offset from the current program counter. But the concept is the same. We just write some extra stuff alongside our relocation saying, fill in this placeholder with the address of putS, but offset it by the current address. We just have a little type information to say what type of placeholder it is. This is also where we deal with what if we wanted 8 bytes for an address versus 4, we'd have the information about how big is the placeholder. So another little thing, less than little thing, is that I imply that when we produce the executable, it's just all ready to run. And this is a real thing that people do, but this is known as static linking. Commonly on modern systems, the linking is actually done in large part when the application is loaded. And the main motivation for this is, let's say, you know, think about, say, printf. I have ls, I have emacs, I have tons of applications on my system which all use printf. And the code for printf is not that small. It's a pretty complicated function to implement. I would really like to have only one copy of it. So our solution is that we're going to store a file with one copy of it, and when the program starts, we're going to load that one copy and use it. And this means that we don't have, you know, hundreds of copies of printf on our disk. This also means that if I find a bug in printf, I fix my one file with a copy of it, and all my programs have the less buggy version of printf, rather than needing to relink hundreds of programs. And so this is commonly done when the application starts. So when we load the executable file, we don't just load the executable file, we also load the libraries it uses into memory. And if you're looking at, like, in the debugger, you'll commonly see extra indirection when this is done. So we could do the exact same thing I talk about, where we have placeholders for every time I call putS and so on to fill in. And that would work, and that is a valid option, but typically systems that do dynamic linking do some extra indirection. So rather than having a placeholder for every call to printf, they'll have a table of function pointers that they fill in, and they'll replace the calls to printf with a lookup in that table, just to make the loading a little faster. So any questions on dynamic linking? So this is the default on pretty much every system you know about. you can request the other type of linking where everything is put in the executable without anything done at runtime with the minus static option to GCC or plain. That does the other type of linking, which is still an option. It has the advantage that your program won't change if the implementation of printf changes, which can be important for some things if you care about consistency, things running the same on every system. But it means your program's much bigger and you have to recompile to get a new version of printf if that's something you want. And if you look at a typical, say, Linux system, there's a lot of dynamically linked libraries which are used. So for example, there's a command ldd on Linux, which lists the libraries loaded by an executable. So here I'm running it on the program that binls, which is what the ls command is. And you can see it uses probably more libraries than you thought it would use. We have, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 libraries that it loads when it starts. And this is pretty typical, and if you look at like a program like Firefox, this list gets a lot bigger. And this is all to avoid having multiple copies of each of these, all the functions in these libraries around on disk. So any questions about linking? Okay, so now I'm going to move on to talking a bit about assembly. So when I was going over linking, I showed you some AT&T syntax assembly, and I'd like to talk about differences between AT&T and Intel syntax relatively quickly, just so you can get used to reading it. It's in our textbook. It's the default on OS X and Linux, so I want you to be able to deal with it. And so we'll go through the differences that correspond to each of these. So here's an example of AT&T syntax. What this does is it takes the value 42, it copies it into memory at the address specified by the register RBX. So, which I've shown here, 42, move into memory at the address specified by RBX. And I've shown you in AT&T syntax and Intel syntax, and we'll go through each of the parts of this assembly. So the first thing to note is that the destination is last. And this is always, always true in AT&T syntax assembly. The destination is always last. If it helps you remember, I like to, you can think of replacing the comma with an arrow pointing to the right. We use parentheses to represent a value in memory when that's how we're using a register to find a value in memory. The parentheses represent that, kind of like square brackets do in Intel syntax. We use dollar signs in front of constants. If we don't have a dollar sign there, it represents a memory address 42, not the constant 42. We'll talk about that later. Registers always start with a percent sign. If you don't have a percent sign, it's a label instead, like a function called RBX instead of the address. So instead of the register RBX. We have this suffix here, which indicates the length of the instruction. So in this case, I don't know, it's hard to tell whether 42 is a 1 byte value or a 4 byte value or what. The Q means it's 8 bytes. So these are named based on 16-bit x86. So Q is quad, 4 times 16. W, the word, the natural size, is 16. And L for long is 4, and B for byte is 1. You'll sometimes see these omitted. So for example, for something like move RAX into RBX, we don't need to specify the size because we know these are 64-bit registers. And so, I could write move Q, but I don't have to. So any questions on what I've shown here? Yes? because of this, this represents the length of the operands of the instruction. So Q just means 8. We'd use L for 4, W for 2, and B for 1. So if I had move B 42 into RBX, this would just move 1 byte instead of 8. Other questions? Okay. So if you vaguely remember assembly from 2150, you may remember that Intel syntax assembly had things which were much more complicated than that. So here's the general way of accessing memory addresses. And there's some odd conventions here. So here, we put outside the parentheses an offset that is added to produce the address. And this is where the analogy of the parentheses are like the square brackets breaks down. They aren't really. So that 100 there is what's added to the produce the address to the values we get from registers. Then we have our first register we specify is added to the address, and we have our second register along with a scale factor. And this scale factor has to be 1, 2, 4, or 8. Those are the only possible options. And so that's RCX times 4 in this case. And you'll sometimes see names for these. This is called the base. This is called the index. And this is called the scale. And this is sometimes called the offset. So questions, this correspondence? Yeah?
If we put a negative sign on the offset, does that just mean like subtract like 100?
So the question is, if you do minus 100, so on, does that mean subtract 100 instead of add it? Yes. And you can do that just adding a negative number. You can try to do that at least, yeah?
If you only had like one register and you wanted to scale that, is there a way to do that? Or
would you the question is, if you only have one register, when to scale it? So it turns out that you could omit each of the parts of this syntax. If you omit the offset, it defaults to 0. If you omit a register, it defaults to 0. So you can, in fact, take one register and scale it. And there are two syntaxes for doing that. And this is just where we've omitted the first register. If you omit a register, it defaults to 0. As a special case, you don't have to put the leading comma in to omit the first register. Do whatever you think is clearest. And you can also omit the last two registers and just have no scale. I guess in the scale, I should mention, this defaults to 0. The scale defaults to 1, which means that here, it's RBX plus RCX, RCX times 1. I just didn't write the times 1. So you can omit any of the values, and they just default to 0 or 1. And notably, you could omit everything in parentheses, in which case this you get the, if you just specify a number, it's an address case. Any questions about this? Okay, so earlier I mentioned that the destination is always last. And there is one consequence of this which is a little non-intuitive, and that's how subtract and compare work. It's the same instruction, but the destination is last, and compare has the same ordering as subtract as far as operands. So here we're taking R8 minus RAX. So this, you can think of this as subtract RAX from R8 is a way to help remember that. And it's probably not what you are used to in Intel syntax. And the compare, as we'll probably talk about next time, will compute R8 minus, is going to check R8 minus RAX is greater than or less than 0 is what it's going to be checking. So I mentioned earlier that if you don't have a dollar sign, represents an address. So for example, the first thing reads memory at address 1000, takes that value and adds it into RAX. The second one adds the constant 1000 hex to RAX. Make sure you're choosing the one you care about. Okay, so this is our summary of that. So any questions about AT&T syntax? Okay. Good. So one last thing. You haven't seen this in probably in 2150, or if you did, it didn't come up very much. There are computed jumps, which comes up on the first homework, which is the main reason I'm mentioning it. And in Intel, if you want to jump, use RAX contains an address of a function or piece of code to jump to. The syntax is jump RAX. In AT&T syntax, we need this star to indicate that we're not going to code inside the register, but we're using the register as the place where the code is, to indicate that there's some indirection. And there's also an instruction to read a value from memory and use that as the address of code to jump to. So what this means is that we have, in this case, at address RAX plus 1000, there is a table, and each entry in the table is 8 bytes. And we're going to the RBX entry in the table, and we're pulling out a value, and this points to, some code to run. So we're not running code in the table. The table has a pointer to where the code we're going to run is. And you'll see compilers generate this sometimes. Most notably, this is a common way to implement switch statements, where the table will contain, the pointer to the code to run for case 1, 2, 3, and 4, and so on, rather than having a whole bunch of jump less than, jump equal, comparers, and so on. Any questions about this? Yes. So the question is, what happens if you omit the asterisks? I'm pretty sure that if you omit the asterisk, this is an error, assembler error, because there's no such instruction. I'm not sure what happens if you omit the asterisks in the other case. I think it's also an assembler error, just because that instruction doesn't exist on x86, though you could imagine that being a real instruction that runs the code in the table. It's what you'd be saying without the star. Okay, so any other questions? Okay. So since we know that, I'll just go through quickly an example. So we have an example swap function. If you remember calling convention from 2150, RDI is the first argument, RSI is the second. In this class, our textbook has a copy of the calling convention registers. You can look it up. We don't expect you to memorize it, but we expect you to know to look it up. So this is the equivalent of a swap function. This is taking two pointers to longs and swapping the longs they point to in AT&T syntax assembly. So what this does is we take RDI, we use RDI as a memory address, we copy the value from that based on that memory address into RAX. That's what the first instruction does. So this is remove from memory at RDI into RAX. Second instruction is move from memory at RSI into RDX. So make sense so far? And the other instructions are going to go in the reverse order, so we're going to end up actually, I have the highlighting wrong, I'm afraid, but we're going to end up doing the opposite. We're going to take RDX and we're going to move RDX into the location specified by RDI, so we're going to end up moving this to replace the original 9999. And we're going to end up taking RAX and moving it into location specified by RSI, so we're going to end up putting the 9 value into address 4030. And the final state will be like so. Any questions on this? You can follow along with this. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to some brief assembly notes on things that we didn't cover in 2150 that come up when you're trying to read assembly code like for our first homework. So you probably remember from 2150 that you have overlapping registers. So you have like EAX is the 32 bits of RAX, and so on. I note that this exists for R8, R9, and so on, and they have a different naming convention. So R8D is the lower 32 bits of R8. And R8W is the lower 16 bits of R8, and so on. So these exist for all the registers, pretty much. So a note about these overlapping registers that usually is glossed over, that when you set a 32-bit register, the x86 designers made an arbitrary decision that clears the rest of a 64-bit register. So in this case, I set RAX to be all ones, and if I move one into EAX, that clears the rest of RAX. And this is just an arbitrary rule that they made. So that seems fine. What's not intuitive is that this only happens for 32-bit values, for 16-bit values, it doesn't actually clear the rest. So here I set all of RAX to all ones, I set the last byte using the register name for the lower part of it, it only sets that byte. It's just an arbitrary rule that 32 bits clear it, 16 and 8 don't, and I mention this because when you read compiler-generated assembly, you'll commonly see the compiler do something to a 32-bit register and then use the 64-bit one. This is why it's doing that, because it doesn't need to fix up the hopper bits, they're cleared automatically. Okay. And so a review thing, labels represent addresses, which you probably kind of remember from 2150. Like to be clearer on that, in our assembly, especially in AT&T syntax, they are literally like writing the actual memory address in the assembly. So this means just like doing add q ox 1000 rax and doing add q $ox 1000 rax are different. Add q of string says read from memory at string, add it to RAX, probably not a useful operation. Add q dollar string says use the address string and add it to RAX. That would be a good way of, say, getting to a particular byte of a string. But these are different, but it's just like we substituted the address string ends up having every place we wrote string. Any questions here? Okay, so brief note, that's probably mostly review. So I know you probably saw LEA in 2150, but everyone gets confused by it. So LEA is a x86 instruction that compilers like called load effective address. Its syntax looks like a move, but it skips the memory address. So one way of thinking about this is that if this LEA instruction were a move, it would do RAX gets memory at RAX plus 4. We compute the memory address RAX plus 4, read memory there, store the result in RAX. The LEA means that when we do the LEA instruction, we skip the memory access. So we just put RAX plus 4 into RAX. Another way you can think about this is that this is kind of like the address of operator in C. Like we take an operand, we take the address of it, and store it in the destination. And if you look at compiler code, compilers like using this for things which aren't addresses. Because we never access memory, it doesn't matter if what we compute is actually a memory address. So this LEA4RAX will add 4 to RAX even if RAX is 0. Yes, we can't access memory at address 4, but we aren't trying. We're just computing that net value. So for example, if you ask a compiler to multiply by 5, it might generate this instruction to LEA RAX RAX 4. Remember, this is RAX as a base plus RAX as an index times 4, the scale. So RAX plus RAX times 4 is RAX times 5. And if this were a move instruction, we'd access memory at this address and put the result in RAX. But since it's an LEA, we stop before we access memory and just take that address and shove it in the result RAX. Another example compilers might do is we don't have an add instruction which lets us write into a different register than one of the sources, but we can simulate that with LEA. So this takes RBX plus RCX, adds them together, puts the result in RDX. If we wanted to do that with normal add instructions, we need to do a move first into RDX and then do an add. And it's the same concept. We're computing the address RBX plus RCX. If this were a move, we'd access this memory location. What we do, in fact, is we take the address that we would access and just use it, put it in the result, which is the same as adding the two values together. So any questions on this? Okay, so with that in mind, what's this function? I'll give you a minute. And as a reminder, arg is going to be an RDI/EDI, and RAX/EAX is going to be our return value. Just according to the calling convention, which you would look up if you didn't know.
Okay, that's late. Other than that, it's good.
Who needs more time?
No one's volunteering. Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so most people got it right. It is in fact E. So what happens here is that this first statement is equivalent to EAX gets RDI times 8. That's the address. That's the address we would access if it was a move, but it's a LEA, so we just take that address, put it in EAX. Yes, they have different sizes. This is just gonna ignore the top 32 bits. Some people might ask, why didn't we put EDI here? Because it's specifying an address, we have to use 64-bit registers. We aren't allowed to use 32-bit ones because we're on 64-bit. And then we do a subtraction. And the subtraction goes into EAX. Remember, it's subtract from. So we take EAX gets EAX minus EDI. And so if we fill in, remembering that arg is EDI, we have arg times 8. And we have arg times 8, which is what was just put in EAX, minus arg is what gets put in our return value, which is going to be arg times 7, which is not any one of the options. So any questions about this? Yes?
What gives precedence when you're looking at things with different sizes? Like, what decides how many bytes you're using?
The question is, what decides how many bytes we're using? It's the size of the destination that's most important here. So conceptually, what you should think of as happening is we compute the whole address and we get rid of the top bits. Yeah?
Under the subtraction column, would it be different if we are using, you know, like overlapping knowledge we just taught for, say, not 32-bit, but like a 4-bit, will it still be the same?
If this was like a short.
Yeah.
So if this was doing something with shorts, I believe the compiler would not generate quite this code. It would generate something to clear the top of the register, EAX at least. So other questions? Yeah. So if we had a 16-bit LEA, then the destination would have to not be EAX, but it would have to be something like AX that's actually 16 bits. So remember I mentioned that we could omit the sizes when it's implied? So this is a case where you could have just written LEA instead of LEAL, because it has to be a 32-bit one, because the second operand's EAX. If you wanted a 16-bit LEA, we'd have to specify a smaller register. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Why use RDI instead of EDI?
So because this is an address, we have to compute a 64-bit address because that's the size of our addresses. So we are not allowed to use EDI there. We won't have you write this assembly, but we're just having you read it. I'm just showing you something that could actually be generated. Yeah.
So if you're using a 32-bit computer, then you could put EDI up there?
You would, if you're using a 32-bit x86 assembly, then you would have to use EDI there, yes. Not just could put, but would have to.
Other questions? Okay, so some other review. So when you were covering x86, you probably remember the calling convention. This is the calling convention if you want to look it up. The rest is on the stack. We have these bunch of registers that are used for the first six arguments. The return value is an REX. Don't memorize this. There's a figure in the book. You can refer to this slide. But just remember that you can look it up and that it's mostly in registers. And you presumably kind of vaguely remember from 2150 the idea that you have, you set the values of the argument registers, do a call, move into a return value, do a return. So you call functions using call and return, and call and return work by pushing things on the stack or popping addresses from the stack where to jump to. Another thing about calling conventions that I have to briefly remind you and make sure you know that there's a reference. So functions must preserve certain registers. The call these saved registers, here's a list of them in the calling convention we'll use in this course. You can look this up, it's also in the textbook. Just make sure you remember that you should do that, especially if you end up writing assembly and want to figure out what registers can I use. It's be good to remember, or if you don't remember what they are, you can always save the registers you're trying to use just in case, you know, using the normal push pop sort of. So any questions about calling conventions? So I'm assuming we just have a refresher here so you know where you can refer to, but are there any questions that things people don't remember because it's been a while to talk about? Okay. So one other note on things you might read in assembly. So you'll sometimes see assembly that uses this RIP register, which stands for the instruction pointer. And it's the program counter, it's the address of the next instruction. You can't move into it, but you'll commonly see it used to compute memory addresses. So for example, there's an instruction to move the value that is 500 bytes after the current instruction into a register. It's a thing you can do, and the compilers will sometimes generate this in order to make libraries easier to work, because this way the library can be loaded anywhere in memory and work the same. Also, there's this syntax you'll sometimes see in like .s files where they do label parentheses RIP. And with everything we learned, you'd assume, okay, so that's taking the address of the label, adding it to the program counter, and hoping that's a valid memory address. That seems crazy. It turns out that this is a special case which means the same thing as accessing memory at the address of the label. Even though you would think it doesn't, it's just a special case. It just produces different machine code than the version without RIP in it. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so that's all I'm going to cover about reviewing assembly. There should be enough for your first assignment. That's next week. And we're going to go on to talking about converting C to assembly, things that you've kind of done. And when we're doing this, we're going to want to look at C. And a handy thing to do when thinking about this is to first convert C into more assembly like C. And one handy feature that really exists in C is GoTo, which will let us do this more easily. So GoTo, you can have labels and this GoTo operator. And the GoTo operator, you can basically think of as being translated directly into a jump. And the label in C, you can think of translating directly to an assembly label. The compiler might do something slightly different, but this is sort of what this is intended for. Typically, people will tell you not to use GoTo in C. I've given a code example, which is one of the things which is less controversial use of GoTo, because there's not many other ways in C of breaking out of nested loops. But this is valid C, and we're going to use this to talk about translating C code into assembly, because it's not obvious what should a for loop turn into. So we'll first translate it to a form which is closer to the jumps we have in assembly. So Any questions about GoTo? Okay. So let's start by using this method to translate this piece of code into assembly. So first, I'm going to translate into code which uses GoTo because I know that corresponds to the conditional jump instructions I have. So I'm going to do something like this. And you probably kind of, sort of, did struggle with this when you're doing assembly in 50. So we're going to do this. You know, we're going to just take this and translate this into a if GoTo, which we know we can write in x86 as a compare and a jump less than. And similarly, I have this a plus equals. I know I can write that as an add. This GoTo, I know I can write as a jump. This, I know I can write as a mole. So this is going to be a very mechanical translation into assembly, is the idea. So I'm going to do this first step where I write everything as these GoTo or if GoTo with labels. And then I just translate line by line into assembly, worrying about the details of what type of compare and conditional jump do I use, how do I implement that later on. And this is my recommendation for if you're asked to translate something to assembly. So following this process, we do a compare. So this is computing RBX minus 42 and asking if it's, in this case, less than 0. And if it's less than 0, we're going to jump to after that. Then we have our add queue, and we have the GoTo here translates into a jump, just like I wrote. And we have our multiply instruction. And this is just a very mechanical translation into assembly. So any questions about this translation? So everyone ready to do this on some exam or something? Okay. And we can do the same process for loops. So here's the simplest loop to translate to assembly. I'm going to follow the same idea. I set a variable. I'm going to have a label for the start of the loop because I know I need to get there from the bottom. And I'm going to have my if some condition go back to the start. And I can just translate each of these into a single line. So this is going to be a move. This is going to be a call. This is going to be a subtract or a deck. And this is going to be a compare and a jump greater or equal. And we do that translation. And that's how that works out. So any questions on how I got the code here? So our next topic, now that we've seen basic translation, is to talk about how these compare and jump instructions actually work. So in 2150, I think it's generally been presented as sort of they're a pair of things you put together, and that's just what happens. But there's actually, these are independent instructions, and we could say put like a move here, and something's going to still happen. So what's the rules for that? And the answer is that compare actually sets something known as condition codes. So x86 has these special registers, you can think of them, which are condition codes, and they're set by all arithmetic instructions, almost all of them. And for the purposes of this, compare counts as an arithmetic instruction. We'll talk about exactly what it does. And it stores information about the last result of arithmetic. Was it 0? Was it negative? And so on. And the conditional jump instructions you're used to just read those condition codes. So there's these hidden registers which don't have a logical name, and that's what the jump instructions are using. And they're named based on interpreting the result of subtraction, but as I mentioned here, they're actually about the last arithmetic result. So it's named jump equal is actually jump if the last arithmetic was zero. That's actually what jump equal is. But it's called jump equal because the idea is that you typically use this with something that acts like subtraction, and it turns out that compare is going to act like subtraction. And so to give an example, if we take move minus 10 into REX, 20 into RBX, and compute RBX minus REX is 30, this is positive, so jump less than equal will not be taken. Because it's not less than or equal to zero. If it was a subtraction, it didn't end up that RBX was greater than, comparing it to zero was greater than zero, so it's not less than equal. And we'll pick up on this next time.